George Washington and religious tolerance is the topic of this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is a returning guest, Dr. Peter Lilback, president and founder of Providence Forum. He's also the author with me of a book called George Washington's Sacred Fire. And we're going to focus right now, as I say, on religious tolerance. Dr. Lilback, so great to have you back on the program.
Jerry, it's wonderful to be with you again. Thanks so much.
Sure. Now, I understand George Washington believed in Christianity and all that it entails, which means that Jesus is the only way to God. He also believed that people should be free to practice what they believed or didn't believe. And he envisioned America, as I understand it, as a safe haven, even for, let's say, religious dissidents of all kinds. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. I think if we really wanted to identify Washington the best we can for his theological perspective, he says, "My views of religion as in politics are few." In other words, he's trying to say, I am not a political theorist, nor am I a theologian. He would have fallen into that camp of what we might call today latitudinarians. That would be, we are not going to require everybody to believe exactly the same about theological things. There's going to be room for diversity of beliefs. He said, there are a few key things that I hold. And, well, we certainly believed a lot about politics, but he said his principles are few. I think he said the same thing, is there's certain key things that he really held on to, and then he wanted to give freedom to others. And that's, if you will, that tolerant spirit, that he was not a theologian, he was not establishing a church, and he wanted to let there be room. When he established a new government, he wanted there to be legitimate disagreement as long as there was a general consensus about the government under which these disagreements would be pursued. So now let's take a look at some of his examples and language about this. One of the things he will say is that the epoch in which the American experiment has happened is not in the gloomy era of superstition, but it is in an enlightened age. And so what he's now saying is he is very conscious that the American experiment has happened after the period of medieval persecution and dogmatic obligation for everyone to believe the same thing or else be persecuted by the state and the church. He delights in that. And he says, among these blessings that we have is revelation. He doesn't deny that God has revealed himself, and he says this is one of the blessings that we have in this age. We have the Bible, but we don't have a government that's forcing it on us. And so with that example of how he balances the freedom that we have but still the blessing of the scriptures, we can watch what he does as president. As he's now the unanimously elected president under the Constitution, people are celebrating the beginning of a new American era of our country. And he will write to one religious group after another that have many different views. There'll be Presbyterian, there'll be Anglican, there'll be Congregational. There'll even be some that would be considered less than Orthodox. There would be some that are non-Christian, like Jewish people. And as he writes to all of them, he says, I am very pleased that you are able to have full religious freedom to pursue your views. And all we ask of you is that you be good citizens, respecting the rights of others and support our country. So what he was doing was making it very clear that the country had room for different religious positions, provided that they respected the views of others. And so as he looks at this broader tolerance, he does not, however, limit himself from his own convictions. He will, in fact, continue to worship in an Anglican, now Episcopal, church. He will, in fact, read the Bible before he goes to church. He will, in fact, quote Bible texts or ideas when he's teaching at different points or writing as president. So he continues to be a Christian gentleman in a place with his own denominational tradition, but recognizing that his view and his practice is not establishing it for others. And at this point, he was consciously breaking with what had been the post-Reformation solution with religious differences. You may remember from Western civilization, there was the phrase called cuius regio, eius religio.
Okay. Yeah, in other words, the idea, whoever is the king, the whatever the king's religion is, that's your religion if you live in that king's domain, something
that's
to
exactly
that effect.
Right. The only one who gets to choose a religion is the king, and when he chooses for everybody. Washington says no. Here in America, there's room for many different opinions, but we must work together for the common good of all. But he recognizes as the president, he has a right to be who he is. According to Mrs. Alexander Hamilton, she said she knelt and took communion with the newly inaugurated president right after his inaugural vows in New York City, and he did that in an Episcopal church. He was still an Episcopalian. He was celebrating in his tradition, but recognizing that it was not obligatory on others in his own view. Now, you take it a few steps further, and you actually hinted at this. In a little book that I've written called George Washington and Israel, I try to put together how Washington looked at the Jewish tradition in America. There was no nation of Israel, but there were Jewish people, and Washington was very conscious of this. And one of the things that he will say and when he writes to the Jewish people, and he writes in other letters, is that he hopes the new American country will be a new promised land. He's now quoting right out of the Pentateuch, you know, the promised land, the land that God gave to the Jewish people. And he says he hopes that every man will be able to sit under his own vine and fig tree, and there will be none to make them afraid. In this, he's quoting his favorite Bible verse. We can find it Micah chapter 4 and verse 4, as well as other texts, where he says there's going to be a place of being at home, under your vine and fig tree, your farm, your place of life, your husbandry, of raising your family and livelihood, and no one will make you afraid because of what you believe. You have that freedom. And so he says to the Jewish people and others, I hope that this American country will be a vine and fig tree for the Jew and all the persecuted people of the world, where they can come and find asylum, a safe place to be who they are. They don't have to shed their faith when they come to this new land. They can be who they are, exercising their conscience and their freedom. And so there's a marvelous passage where Washington will say, I did not put my name to the Constitution if I thought it was going to take away the freedom of conscience of any person. So Washington had become persuaded before that there was a First Amendment, that religious liberty was absolutely necessary for people to function, and that made America such a wonderfully welcoming place. So this is part of his belief that religious liberty, freedom of conscience, no established religion, but full rights of everyone to exercise their own religious life as they pursue common good citizenship. And that included the president himself. He recognized, and he actually says this, as president, he recognized everything he did would become a precedent. As the first president, he set precedents for others to follow. And in doing that, his religious life was an example that the president can be exactly who he is when he's elected to office. He does not give up his own rights, but he does not mandate others to follow his practice. Well, this is the great attempt at working out what we see in the First Amendment. Congress or president shall make no laws respecting the establishment of religion, but he will not prohibit the free exercise thereof, that each of us in our own way will have full example of our own conscience in our country. So,
and in fact,
religious
that
liberty and commitment.
Yeah, and that, in fact, that religious liberty issue, the separation of church and state, I want to explore that actually in the very next segment, but this time we're talking really focusing on religious tolerance. And if you don't mind if I go back to something, you said earlier, Washington said that we in his day, live in an enlightened age, you know, as opposed to an age of superstition. Now, there are some who would basically say, yeah, well, what that enlightenment means is unbelief. In other words, you think of David Hume, for example, a great thinker of the Enlightenment. And so there's certainly an anti-Christian aspect to the Enlightenment, but there's also, it could be said, a Christian side to the Enlightenment, as represented by people like Montesquieu, Blackstone, and John Locke. So what are your thoughts about that when Washington said we live in an enlightened age?
There's no question that the Enlightenment has an unbelieving side, and that would get us into that idea of deism, perhaps, or even atheism, that we are free from all religious commitment or divine revelation. But you've already noted, for like example, John Locke, who's a great Christian philosopher, he was consciously a Christian. In fact, he, in one of his writings, talks about how important the inerrant Bible is, the inspired Bible that is the source of the truth of God. He wrote commentaries on Paul's letters, so he's absolutely a Christian theologian, but he's also a philosopher. Now, we may not like his philosophy, but he was trying to show that human thought and divine revelation are not ultimately enemies if they're operating under God. So there is a Christian side of the Enlightenment. And so Enlightenment can be interpreted either as rejecting of everything that's Christian, and that's the very secular view of Enlightenment, or it can be the discovery of the beauty of loving God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So, for example, John Newton, Newtonian physics.
Isaac Newton.
He was loving God with his mind. He was wanting to think God's thoughts after him, and that his Principia Mathematica was actually saying, I'm discovering the great truths that God himself put in the nature so that I can worship him better. Mm. And so that is enlightenment. It's enlightenment of why do the physical spheres operate the way they do? What is the law of gravity? That was done by a man who had a real love for the scriptures.
You know, and this is important because I was just on a hostile radio program the other day, and the fellow was trying to say that the good things in Western civilization we can thank the unbelievers for, not the Christians. It didn't grow out of Christian theology that you had the Enlightenment. And I said, wait a minute now. There are two strands to the Enlightenment. There's the believing side and the unbelieving side. And by the way,
let me give you my favorite example of that coming from Philadelphia. Most of us know that William Penn set up Philadelphia as a haven of religious liberty. Our city, Philadelphia, Philos Adelphos, where brothers love each other, where each of us can have religious freedom and have common civil society. He established the city after writing a book on the freedom of conscience, and you know what he put on the cover of his book? Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12. If you don't know the reference, I bet you know the verse.
It's the do unto others
as you'd have them do unto you, the golden rule. Penn established religious liberty by following Jesus' golden rule and applying it to the public square. That's an extraordinary Christian reality, and it gets codified now in the First Amendment of the Constitution. That is not something the Enlightenment of unbelief brought to us. That is what the Christian Enlightenment brought to us as we began to analyze what would real Christianity say about a civil government that honors those that are made in the image of God living in a common public society.
Did the unbelieving wing of the Enlightenment add anything positive to civilization, especially when we're talking about religious tolerance?
Well, you might be able to argue that scientific discoveries in some cases have come in those early years by people that had said, I'm just doing pure rational research. Christians call that common grace. We don't deny that unbelievers who don't hold to biblical truths can make great insights. We could go step by step and look at different philosophers, scientists, and decide were they Christian or not Christian. We'll find that the whole beginning host of the whole development of the modern scientific experiment were Christians. They were devout Bible believers, and they set the stage for the whole scientific enterprise. Now, today there might be atheists and unbelievers that are making great contributions in science, and we don't deny that. But what we shouldn't allow them to do is to say, you can't do science if you are a serious Christian, because there would be no science if there weren't serious Christians. They invented it. Sir Isaac Newton is one of just a classic example of many.
Exactly. And going back to the overall topic at hand in this particular segment, George Washington and religious tolerance, it is safe to say that he envisioned America as a place where, quoting the Bible, a man could rest under his own vine and fig tree and find a safe haven. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Loback, for this portion. Again, I will refer people to your website, providenceforum.org for more information. And next time,
thanks again, Jerry.
Sure, thank you. And next time I want to talk about George Washington and the separation of church and state.